She was the most dangerous woman in Europe. Well, so says the subtitle of Caroline Moorhead's new biography of Edda Mussolini. Edda was the dictator Benito's favourite daughter and confidant during 20 years of fascist rule. She acted as envoy to both Germany and Britain, helping steer Italy to join forces with Hitler. Now, Edda married Italy's foreign secretary, Galeazzo Ciano. They became a celebrated glamour couple in Roman society. Until, that is, Ciano became involved in a plot to bring Benito Mussolini down. Well, UK historian and author Caroline Moorhead's previous biographies include those of Bertrand Russell and Martha Gellhorn. Her most recent books have focused on resistance to dictatorship and have been shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize, the Orwell Prize and the Costa Biography Award. I started by asking Caroline, what drew her to Edda Mussolini as a subject?
I think two things. One was that I really wanted to write about the fascist years. I wanted to write about what it meant for Italians to live under fascism, the 20 years of fascism. And for that, I needed a sort of narrative thread. So I looked around to find somebody who, in a sense, represented it all and was also, in her own way, important. And the point about Edda was she was Mussolini's eldest daughter. She was 12 when he came to power. And for the next 20 years, she was the sort of acceptable face of fascism. And it was very mixed and muddled because on the one hand, she was everything fascists were meant to be. And on the other, she obeyed none of the rules.
What do you mean by that?
Fascism in Italy meant absolutely everything was prescribed. What people wore, what they did, their leisure, what they read, women not having jobs and so on. Among all these things was a diktat. The women would not smoke, and Edda smoked like a chimney. They wouldn't drink. Edda smoked heavily. They wouldn't wear trousers. That's about all she wore. They wouldn't dance, and that's what she did. So she saw herself as somehow above the rules.
The most dangerous woman in Europe is the subtitle on the front cover. What was it about her that made her worthy of that moniker?
I think it's where you come into that area, that grey area between influence and power. On paper, she had no actual power. She was the wife of the foreign minister and Mussolini's favourite child. However, she was the confidant both for her father Mussolini and her husband Ciano. And they listened to her. She was a very, very strong character. She had very strong opinions. They listened to her about the people around him, around them both. Mussolini increasingly wanted to get close to the Germans because he thought that that would be better for Italy. Ciano thought the opposite. Ciano wanted to stay on the Allied side. But Edda was sent off on a sort of mission to Germany and in 1938. And they tremendously courted her, gave her parties for her. She got to know Himmler and Goering and Goebbels. And she came back to Italy saying, you know, these are our allies. These are the people we need to be in with. Now, she had no power to make any decisions, but there was no question that Mussolini listened to her.
So take us back to where I suppose her story begins. As you say, she was 12 when her father seized power. What was significant from her childhood that stood out to you when you were researching?
I think it was as much as anything her character. For the first 12 years of her life, she was the daughter, as it were, of a socialist journalist, often in prison, very, very poor. They lived in extreme poverty. He took her everywhere with him, and he partly took her everywhere to his meetings, to his offices and so on. Because she was so sparky and she was watchful and she was full of curiosity, and he loved her best, there was no question. And I suppose what really intrigued me was that this wild, almost feral little girl growing up observing the sort of chaos that was Italy at the end of the First World War and sort of emerging as this strong figure full of contradictions. I mean, she was shy, yet she was bold. She was modest, yet she was vain. Maybe very hard to turn out any other way if you're the daughter of a dictator. But it was the contradictions which really interested me.
And what did she learn, do you think, from her father? How did he shape her?
I think one of the things he felt very strongly about was that Mussolini should show no fear. And there was a story about her when she was a little girl, which he was really terrified of, was frogs. And Mussolini went out one day or asked somebody to bring him a frog, get him a frog, and he made her carry it around. And I mean, it was a horrible thing to do, but he didn't want her frightened. He wanted her bold. He wanted her decisive. He wanted her to sort of represent what he believed girls should be like. They're not, of course, really fascist girls, but I think he admired her hugely. He admired her cleverness. And he wanted really to mould her to be like him.
It was a pretty interesting relationship between Mussolini and his wife, Rachel. For Edda, growing up and observing this, what did she take from that?
Oh, I think one of the most important lessons she took was not a good one, which is that Mussolini was extremely unfaithful to his wife. And Rachel sort of accepted it on the grounds that, you know, men were allowed to do these things and women were not. And there were terrible rows all the time. So she took from her young childhood these ghastly rows, this family unhappiness, and at the same time, the fact that men anyway should be able to have affairs and that shouldn't count against them. Now, she herself later had affairs. So I think probably she grew up thinking that this was okay to do. I suppose she grew up also thinking you have to fight for what you can get. Nothing comes to you easily. That you have to be bold. You have to be brave. I think those were the main things really she took from him.
And that relationship with her mother was a much more complex, a much colder relationship than the one she had with Benito Mussolini.
That was certainly true. I mean, she didn't get on with her mother from a very young age. She was her father's child, really. Rachele was a very interesting figure, and I think rather underrated figure, because she remained, even when they went to Rome and lived in great grandeur, she remained a sort of largely peasant woman, and she didn't want to have any of the social life that went with being the dictator's wife. And it was Edda, therefore, who took it over. And Edda went off to China for 2.5 years with her husband, who was then a consul. And she sort of learnt how to manage these things. She learnt manners, she learnt English, she learnt how to present herself. So when she came back to Italy in 1932, she sort of took over her mother's role.
Yes, the role of women in fascism is an interesting one. How was she seen? How was she accepted by many of the people surrounding her father?
I think she always remained a difficult figure. One of the problems for the fascists was being the grand fascist, the leaders, and Mussolini and the men who surrounded him, was being accepted by the Roman life, if you like. And Roman life was both very snobbish and very provincial and very aristocratic. And they had very little desire to get involved with these vulgar, crass, demanding fascists. I think one of the challenges for all of them was how to find a place in this new Rome, if you like, new fascist Rome with the aristocracy of fascism. And I think that's where Edda and her husband Ciano really came in useful.
Yes, she was very young, or she seems very young to me at 19, when she got married, and taking on those sorts of roles as wife and then of mother. How did that sit with her?
I think the first thing that happened is when she went to China, when she went to Shanghai, indeed at 19, she was overwhelmed by how wonderful it was. It was all that Rome was not. Rome was stuffy and quiet and sort of backbiting. And Shanghai was colourful, exciting, things going on, visually wonderful and so on. When she came back to Italy, she had one child while she was away, and she was expecting another. And her heart sank. I don't think at the beginnings in the early 30s, I think she was desperately trying to find how she would fit in with this Italy that she didn't like nearly as much as China. I mean, she would always say in later life that the China years were the happiest for her.
Yes, her lifestyle was one that certainly for a woman at the time was perhaps a little unusual. She was very interested in gambling and poker playing.
That was totally unusual, yes, and she lost a great deal of money. It was totally unusual, but that sort of goes along with what she was like. And when she gets back to Rome, you know, though she finds friends both in the sort of junior aristocracy and also among the slightly looser people in Rome to gamble with. So she goes right on gambling through the 30s.
And the relationship with her husband, he was also foreign minister, I think, for Mussolini, for her father in the regime. Was that a happy marriage?
Well, another reason why she was good for me to write about, or why I enjoyed it so much. The thing is, I think when she married him, she probably didn't love him, but she quite soon did love him. And then she discovered he was having a lot of affairs. And there was a singular moment in Shanghai when she made this resolution she would not be jealous and she would pursue her own life. And so, therefore, through the 30s, right up at the war and into the war, they had a pretty detached marriage. She got on with what she was doing. She saw a lot of Mussolini. She did what political work she could. And he had countless affairs. But then the great tragedy in their life happens. Ciano is part of the group of high-up fascists who vote to topple Mussolini in the summer of 1943. And very sensibly, all those who voted against him saw that the wind was not really going to change in their favour. The king had Mussolini arrested. Most of them vanished, went abroad, went into hiding. But Ciano thought actually that he was safe because he was married to Mussolini's daughter. And for several months, he kept on thinking that nothing bad was going to happen to him. They went to join Mussolini in Germany because the Germans had rescued Mussolini and they were about to reinstall him in a puppet government in the north. And Edda and Ciano got themselves to Germany, where they really thought it was all going to be all right. But the trouble was Hitler wanted the conspirators punished, and so really did Mussolini. So when Ciano foolishly flew back to Italy, thinking that he was going to be all right, he was arrested and he was held by a combination of the fascists with German, you know, German involvement, if you like. And Hitler was demanding that the five on trial who'd been caught get the death penalty. And Mussolini could have stopped that. There was a moment when he, it was several moments, he could have stopped that happening, but he didn't.
He really wrestled with it, though, didn't he?
He really wrestled with it, but in the end, he did nothing. By all accounts, Mussolini sat at his desk and agonized about what to do. However, he didn't reprieve Ciano. He let the execution go ahead. And there was a very dramatic series of adventures when Edda tried to barter for her husband's life with his diaries that everybody wanted and the Germans wanted. And she thought she'd made a deal. And the deal fell through because Hitler got to hear of it. And he said, if anybody favours this deal and gets Ciano released, I'll have him shot. So the conspiracy to free Ciano fell through. And even as Edda crossed to Switzerland with the diaries, he was shot. So suddenly you get this position where her father, her much, much loved father, has had her husband shot. And in the months leading up to that execution, for the first time, probably, Edda and Ciano got very close.
Yes, it was. It's an extraordinary story. It feels like it's something out of a spy novel or something, with Edda desperately trying to get her husband's reprieve. And the Germans also instrumental to some extent, certainly giving Mussolini some steel behind making that final decision.
Certainly. There was a famous telephone call, which was, I think, captured, so I think there's no doubt about it, when Mussolini rang up the senior German general in Italy, Wolf, and said to him, "What do you think would be Hitler's reaction if I didn't go through with this?" And Wolf made it absolutely plain that he would consider Mussolini much weaker. And at this stage, Mussolini was desperate not to be perceived as weak by the Germans.
What was Edda's reaction to her father's decision?
She was appalled, because I think she had really imagined that there was a new life for her in Czarno, that she had suddenly got close to him, and suddenly it all appeared as if they would have a happy life. And she was, of course, absolutely devastated by what her father had done, and she never spoke to him again. He sent messages, he sent couriers, he sent her money, but she never saw or spoke to him again.
Was that probably the defining moment of their relationship?
Yes, I think it probably was. Mm. One of the most interesting things I found was this interview that she gave somewhere towards the end of her life. And she was asked by the interviewer, what did you feel about your father? And she said, "He was the only man I really loved." And so I see it rather as a Greek tragedy, really. I mean, in a way, the whole of her life is rather like a Greek tragedy.
Yes, the only man she'd ever loved, but also because she had loved him, she was able to hate him too.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So at what point in her life do you think she had the greatest level of power and influence over her father?
I think it was maybe in the late 1930s, just as Italy was debating whether or not to join the war. In fact, they didn't go into the war in 1939. They waited until the Germans invaded France in the spring of 1940. And then, in a way, Mussolini, if he was going to be with Germany, had to make up his mind and jump then. And I think in that period, I think Edda was instrumental by saying to him, I think you have to do this. I think you have to show that Italy is strong. I think you have to win back for Italy some of the prestige it lost in the First World War. And there was a general feeling after all at that time that Germany was likely to win the war. And Edda, for that brief period, was very sort of gung-ho about the Germans. I mean, of course, later she totally turned on them. But at that early moment, she was very much in favour of them.
And realistically, how much actual power did she have? I mean, she was right at the centre of power. She was her father's confidant for much of the time. Was she actually able to exert that in overt ways?
Well, it's so difficult to answer that question. I mean, I think it goes back again to the question of what is influence and what is power. I think if I had to define it, I mean, I took that quote from a newspaper article because that's how she was being referred to. Do I think she was the most dangerous woman in Europe? No, I don't. But I think she's one of those figures who had enormous influence and who's largely been neglected by history. I mean, nobody thinks to bother about Edda Mussolini, because after all, who was she? She was his eldest daughter. And I think the interesting thing for me when I was writing this book was discovering the extent to which she was a player at that time. And in those particular years when women were absolutely without power or influence of any kind, she emerged as an immensely strong figure.
How hard was it to research her and to find information about her? Because, as you say, she was the daughter and to some extent very much in the background.
Yes, but you have to remember that Mussolini had the most fabulous archives, in the sense that a police chief under him called Bocchini set up this extraordinary network of informers. There were spies and informers everywhere, at every dinner, and every drivers, maids, friends, priests. everybody was informing, and they would send in reports on everything, and they would be typed up, and the interesting ones would be sent over to Mussolini. So that was a huge source of seeing her through other people's eyes. There are many, many memoirs written of the time. She herself, like all prominent Italians, she herself wrote a memoir. Rachele wrote a memoir. Many of the other Mussolinis wrote memoirs. One of her sons wrote a memoir saying when granddad had daddy killed. After the war, there were countless interviews and papers and photo, long photo extracts from things. And, you know, I just went back to all those archives. I just combed through all the archives, very good archives in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You know, that's the fun of research, is it's like following endless bits of string. Mm. And many of them give you nothing. And then suddenly, bingo, you're given a file which is full of wonderful information. And I talked to surviving Mussolinis. I talked to her daughter, Edda's daughter-in-law. You know, you pick up things here and there.
Yeah. What was it about her that perhaps most surprised you as you were going through that research?
Oh, it's always difficult, isn't it? It's difficult to know what is surprising. I suppose what surprised me, I know what surprised me. What surprised me was she kept going, is that even when it all was so terrible, she did not let herself be defeated. So I was surprised by that. I would like to have found more humour in her. I didn't find a great deal of humour. I was surprised at the things that she got involved in. Like, she became amazingly a nurse in the Second World War, and this highly social, glamorous, difficult, opinionated woman was much regarded as a nurse. She was considered a really good nurse. Mm. That surprised me. She was a terrible mother. Did that surprise me? Maybe not. You know, you get your surprises in tiny little byways rather than across her whole picture.
Mm. How committed a fascist was she?
Oh, probably not very. She would say all her life after the war that she admired her father and she admired the things he'd done. And she was right to do so, because what I think is always forgotten about Mussolini, which is right up until the mid-1930s, right up really until the Spanish Civil War, and when he got close to Hitler after that, Mussolini, in fact, did a lot of good for Italy. You know, it wasn't the old cliche just about making the trains run on time. He put through a lot of mother and children programs. He improved the education. He produced for the first time paid holidays for workers. He laid on popular trains that people could travel around very cheaply. He built roads. He built infrastructure. He did a lot of good for Italy before all that happened. And I think that's what one rather forgets about him.
She did push against a great many aspects of fascism, certainly, I suppose, some of the constraints that were placed on women. Was that something that she explicitly found difficult with fascism?
Or did she just do the opposite? I mean, I think she didn't really think the rules applied to her. Was she a great believer in fascism? I think she was a believer in a strong Italy. She was a believer in some of the programs that happened. I think she was never a believer in the sort of straitjacket it put on Italians. But as I say, since she didn't really think the rules applied to her, she wasn't really sort of bound by them. Mm. She wasn't a tremendous political thinker. I think you really do have to say that. She was not greatly educated. She was shrewd. She was very shrewd about people. She was shrewd about things that were happening. But I think she was probably quite lazy intellectually. I think she didn't really concern herself deeply with politics. But then when she was given a mission, like when she was sent to England in 1935 by her father, you have to bear in mind how young she was still at this point. Mm. She came because Mussolini wanted to know what the British would do if he decided to occupy and invade Abyssinia. And while she was in England, you know, she went around, she saw a lot of people, she saw Macdonald, the Prime Minister, she met the King, she listened, she asked questions and so on. And when she came back to Italy, she had a pretty clear understanding, or she thought she had, and it was right, that if Mussolini went ahead, in the end, the British would complain, but they wouldn't actually do anything.
How was she portrayed by the media across her life? Because she does say at one point about not being cut out to be an ordinary woman.
That's right. I mean, the point is, I suppose, on balance, it was more hostile, and certainly more as time went on. Under fascism, there was total censorship. So until the fascists went, there was nothing appeared critical other than all these letters, many, many letters, along with all these spy reports, came into Mussolini, and some of them were very critical of her behaviour. When she was in Switzerland, there was a huge amount of protest by the Swiss against her personally because what she was like, and against her because she was the wife of Ciano and the daughter of Mussolini. After the war, well, she was pretty much left alone. I mean, she did retire into sort of obscurity, which is why I end the book in 1949. When she appeared in the press, it wasn't too damaging to her. But, you know, she tried her very best to sort of disappear from life after the war because she didn't want the sort of prominence that had come with her fascist ties.
And after the war, especially, although it was something that came up earlier in her life too. Was she most at home when she was on the island of Capri?
Yes, definitely. She loved Capri. And all through the 30s, you know, it was her escape from the sort of her demand, the demands on her in Rome. She had a house on Capri and she loved being there. And she went there as often as she possibly could, sometimes with the children, sometimes without. Again, she was a terrible mother when she was there. You know, children used to say that she would be getting up when they were coming back from the beach and that they would look anxiously at her face to see, you know, if it was cloudy and angry or if she was in a good mood. But that's where she loved it and that's where she was happiest, yes. And she took up with Emilio Pucci, the designer, the man who later became the famous Italian designer of clothes. And he, in fact, was the person who helped her when she was trying to exchange the letters. And she went skiing with him. She loved skiing. She went to Venice and to the film festival. So, you know, there was all that that she really enjoyed.
She wasn't executed like her father and her husband. So what does that tell us? Does that indicate that she was less consequential than they were, or just seen that way?
I think she wasn't as consequential, and she was seen not to be, not least because she was a woman. She herself thought that she might very well be executed for her asylum, and they kept her for 2 years. But in the summer of 1945, the Allies turned her over to the Italians on the understanding that the Italians would not execute her. And they put her in prison, if you like, in detention on the island of Lipari, which was where, before the war, Mussolini had sent all his anti-fascist opponents. And she wrote a long memorandum trying to sort of lessen the impression that she had been powerful. And they sentenced her to a few years, but she was then let out in an amnesty.
Yeah, how did the rest of her life play out?
I think she's lonely. She lives in Rome. She sees a lot of her children. She plays poker, she drinks, she travels. She didn't marry again, but I think she was very lonely.
How sympathetic do you feel towards her?
That's all so difficult. I think it's very important if you're a writer and you're writing a sort of biography stroke history that you don't early on fall out with the person you're writing about because otherwise it makes such a disagreeable period of your life. So I made it my business not to fall out with her. Sometimes she amused me. And in the end, with a great sort of tragic denouement, I felt terribly sorry for her.
Yes, it is a very human story, isn't it, that one? I was also intrigued that you say that not every incident in the book is true. And I suppose that idea of misinformation and perception being reality is one, of course, that we grapple with so much now. And interesting to see that some of that myth-making, if you like, exists here too.
Absolutely. I'm sure that's absolutely right. And I mean, the thing is that if ever there was a land of myths, it was fascist Italy. The Duce, the Mussolini, was this mythical figure. Everything was about the grandeur of him. And, you know, myth persisted. And why I put that at the beginning of the book was simply I didn't want to be caught out by somebody saying, hey, you've got that wrong. I did my best, but very often I was sort of dealing with material that was itself contradictory. And I just simply had to sort of steer a path along what I thought was right.
Caroline, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, or this evening for you. Absolutely fascinating. And I really enjoyed the book. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. That was really kind of you.